This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. After a closely scrutinized legislative session, Florida lawmakers went back to their districts in mid-May, but now they're headed back to Tallahassee to have a look at a restructured version of the budget that they passed before they went home. That budget is $400 million lighter after meetings between Governor Rick Scott and House Speaker Richard Corcoran, and then it was presented to Senate President Joe Negron, according to reports from the Miami Herald, which went on to say that some lawmakers weren't even aware of the discussions until Scott, Negron, and Corcoran held a joint news conference last week. At that news conference, it was announced that lawmakers would return to Tallahassee this Wednesday for a three-day session to finalize a budget that Governor Scott indicated he'd be willing to sign. Joining me now in the studio is Senator Kathleen Pasadomo, who represents the 28th District of Florida, which encompasses Collier, Hendry, and the southern part of Lee County, to talk about that budget and what it means for Southwest Florida. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We are talking with Senator Kathleen Pasadomo about her work in Tallahassee and what to expect as she and other lawmakers head back to the Capitol for a three-day special session. Call in and ask your questions at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Now, tell me, when did you find out you were heading back to Tallahassee? Was it a surprise to you two?
It was a surprise, but not really. I found out, I think, Wednesday. There was some discussions last Wednesday, and then for sure on Thursday. Then the Senate president sent out an email, a notice, and then everybody started talking about it.
Yeah. So is it kind of known that it's usually going to be a three-day special session, or do those kind of time things, are they elastic?
Yeah, they're pretty elastic, and hopefully we won't take all 3 days. The call was for this Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. The Senate president basically said, for travel purposes, we don't have to be there till Wednesday at 1. Of course, Coming from Southwest Florida, I've got to go tomorrow because it's
Absolutely. That's a long drive. It's a long, boring drive. How much does a special session cost taxpayers?
I understand it's about $50,000, $60,000 a day.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine this is something that you would rather not have to do.
Absolutely. I would prefer not to have to do that.
So what do you think led to this?
Well, I think the governor had been saying all along throughout session that his number one priority, or number one and two, was funding for Enterprise Florida and funding for Visit Florida and increasing the dollars allocated per pupil funding for K through 12. Those were his priorities, and the legislature, didn't meet those priorities. So the thought that I had was, what was he going to do? You know, you kind of figure it out. Would he veto the entire budget? If he did, we'd have to come back. Would he veto large parts of the budget? And depending on how much, would we come back? So I think it was not a surprise that we would have to revisit it. It was a surprise just because I didn't want to have to do it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Were you surprised, though, to hear that the budget had been negotiated between House and Senate leaders without the rest of the legislature around? I mean, did that come as a shock to you?
Not really. It has to start somewhere. And so the issues were really between the Speaker of the House and the governor, because the Senate had pretty much all along wanted to support the governor's initiative for Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. And we compromised with the House in order to get the budget done. So there had to be discussions between the governor and the Speaker, because the governor was going to veto a lot of projects. And so there was a conversation. I don't have a problem with that, as long as I get an opportunity to review where they're going. And frankly, I believe that the House is coming closer to where the Senate was all along. So I'm good with that.
So once they made the announcement that everybody's going back up for a special session, you got a copy of what has been kind of drafted or drawn up?
The House has a bill that they filed. And in fact, I just printed it out today so I could take a look at it tonight before we head up and see, you know, what they're looking at, what they would like to do. And from what I understand, it does exactly what the governor had requested, which is to fund Enterprise Florida, fund Visit Florida, and put more dollars per pupil in K through 12.
So there's been a lot of talk about transparency. From the Governor Scott, he was saying this, aiming it at the legislature, then the legislator to legislator. What does something like this do to kind of the image of being a transparent process?
Well, it you know, the public then looks at it and presumes that everything is done, you know, in secret and behind closed doors. I'm not sure how the House worked it this year, obviously because I don't serve in the House, but I do know in the Senate we had – because there's only 40 of us in the Senate, there's a lot of conversations, a lot of discussion. So I don't feel like the process was hidden away from the Senate.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of hard. The more people that you have, it's hard to get that many people together to get in on a conversation too.
That's true.
So what do you hope to see happen when you get back up to Tallahassee?
Well, I have all along been supportive of the governor's initiatives with Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. And so I'm very hopeful that we will be able to put more funds into those two initiatives. And the reason I feel that way is that throughout session, the House took this position funding of Enterprise Florida was, you know, they used the buzzwords corporate welfare and picking winners and losers. And I dispute that because of what we have experienced in Southwest Florida. We've had a huge win-win for the entire area, and that is with the governor's initiatives and all the leadership in Southwest Florida brought Hertz from New Jersey to Bonita Springs, and that was a win-win for everybody. The community benefited. Hertz benefited. There were no losers because there was no company that got shut out. In fact, the entire area was a winner. And so I look at that experience and say, if we can replicate that throughout the state, that's a good thing. The House took the position that there were a lot of initiatives that were not successful, and they're right. But do you throw the baby out with the bathwater, or do you make the process better? And so now what we're hopefully going to do is make the process better, make Enterprise Florida more accountable. Some of the arguments that we heard throughout session from members of the House about contracts that were awarded that were not proper, or whatever. Okay, let's fix it. Let's do the right thing. And I even filed a bill that didn't get a hearing that would have made Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida much more transparent, much more accountable.
Mm-hmm. And this deal also pledges to restore some funding to Visit Florida. Are you in support of that too?
Oh, absolutely. What I mentioned to a lot of people, as soon as this started coming up about we don't want to put any money into Visit Florida. That's how it started originally. And then they ended up with $25 million. The first thing you saw were ads from all over the country saying, visit Texas, visit Georgia, because they were like sharks circling the tank saying, well, we're gonna suck away Florida's visitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you see there are a lot of states. I've even seen Visit Arkansas. So there are a lot of people investing in that. Do you know if any of the projects that are getting vetoed in the most recent version of the budget, are any of those in Southwest Florida?
Yes, there were. First of all, I will say that I was very happy that, I'm looking at my list of projects. Only a few were vetoed. So we fared very well in Southwest Florida. Unfortunately, one of our number one priorities in Naples, the accelerator for the Immokalee program, was vetoed. I'm committed to working on that again and also working with them in Enterprise Florida. If we're going to put more funding into Enterprise Florida, that would be appropriate for the Naples Accelerator or the Immokalee Accelerator to start working with Enterprise Florida. So that was one.
Is that something, though, that you can do now that they've gotten this version of a budget done? Is there any way for you to go in and say, well, hey, look, I would rather have this money come back to this project, or if you can't make that happen, can I take money out of the Enterprise or reallocate some money from Enterprise Florida and put it over there? Is that something that can happen realistically?
No, not realistically at all in terms of manipulating the budget, if you will. But if funds are going to be distributed to Enterprise Florida, my suggestion would be to go to Enterprise Florida. That's not part of our budget process.
Okay.
That's a good question. I've gotten a lot of calls from people saying, how do we were, our project was vetoed. can you get to the governor and ask him to what kind of appeal process is it? There really isn't one, because we have a budget dollar amount. It's the $83 billion and change. That can't change. That's what was allocated. Our original budget was to that amount. So for the additional funding that the governor wants for Enterprise Florida, Visit Florida, and the K-12, other items had to come off the budget. It ends up being about $400 million. So there's nothing to appeal, because there's no money there unless we reduce the amount to Enterprise Florida and Visit Florida. I don't see that happening.
So the recourse then for example, I'm just going on with this example of the accelerator there. They would then redirect their inquiries towards Enterprise Florida in order to get the funding that they want.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a conversation. That also means that this isn't a drop dead thing, because next year we have another budget. And so maybe we ask in a different way, maybe do a different program. Mm-hmm. We most of the items that we had did get funded. Florida Gulf Coast did not get as much funding as was in the budget. I'm a little disappointed in that. Some of the projects that I'm very, very excited about are funded. The Fakahatchee Strand Visitor Center, Lover's Key, that funding's. And these are really important to Southwest Florida. So, and some of the social service programs he did not cut. And the one that we got in towards the end for the Harry Chapin Food Bank, which is vitally important to our older citizens, Southwest Florida, they're still in there. So I feel very blessed that Southwest Florida is taken care of in the budget.
Do you anticipate that there's going to be any action on the medical marijuana amendment during this special session?
The call did not include it, so it would be highly unlikely. And we would certainly have to – bills would have to be filed, because there are no bills. So I don't see that. My personal feeling is that, we have an obligation. The voters have spoken. We could not come to agreement between the House and the Senate. We will have to do that at some point. But we are also fortunate that in 2014, when the legislature passed the legislation surrounding Charlotte's Web, we put into place a framework for that. And so it's not like there's nothing there. The Department of Health can operate under the framework that was created under the Charlotte's Web scenario. The problem, of course, is they only have three employees, so they're going to have to ramp up. And I don't see why we can't help them in the interim and then come back in August and get it done.
So do you feel like it's okay just for the time being leaving it up to the Department of Health, but then the legislature looking at it again?
I believe so. And the thing about it is, right now there are the number of people that have gone through the process of registering and the doctors that have registered is fairly small. And it will grow over time, but I think we can manage it in the interim without, as you said earlier, the dollar per day to go to Tallahassee is pretty high. I think it's important that we have to be there for the budget. I don't think we should have to come back again in July or August, beginning of August, for medical marijuana when we're coming back for committee weeks already in August.
Did it surprise you that it was so difficult to get something like that passed?
The medical marijuana?
The medical marijuana. Because, I mean, it was an amendment. It was written out. People voted for it. 73% people approved it. And then it just came through the legislature. And the Senate had a real simple bill. The House had a more, with more stipulations added onto it. They just couldn't get together by the end of session to make that happen. Did that surprise you that was so tough?
It did, actually, but I almost had a front row seat to it, because I serve on the Health Policy Committee, which is where the bill originated in the Senate. And I actually I'm vice chair of that committee, and I happened to chair the meeting at which it was presented. There are so many people invested in this issue. So many businesses. There's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of money. And whenever there's a lot of money and there's a lot of people that want to make a lot of money on it, so that as many scenarios as there are people that want to make a lot of money are involved in this process. And so we have to make sure that whatever we do, we have to safeguard the public. We have to make sure that we don't end up having, like what happened in California, there's some cartels sort of taking over, and we've got to regulate it. And so if we don't do it right in the beginning, it'll get out of control.
So how do lawmakers approach a voter-backed initiative like that? Whenever you have a clear-cut mandate from voters that says, this is what we're for, do lawmakers like having that kind of information from voters going forward? Or does it make it harder for them to make sure that they get it done?
Well, first of all, the amendment was not as specific as people think. It provided for the medical use of marijuana, but it left it up to the legislature to determine how, what, when, and where. Little things like when you use the word use, who gets to use it? What kind of debilitating illness versus chronic pain? Which is a problem, because that chronic pain issue gets back down to the pill mill thing. So the legislature has got to regulate it so that the people who truly need the drug can get the drug without having to jump through hoops. But also, we need to prevent it from turning into, for all intents and purposes, legalization. And I will tell you that right after the amendment passed, I started getting emails from people saying, when can I get my marijuana? And they were not people who needed it for medicinal purposes. They thought that we actually legalized marijuana in the state. And there are a lot of people who thought that.
There's a lot of misperception. Did you get a lot of feedback from people, though, as you were going through the legislative process this year? People that were concerned, that were kind of more medical marijuana proponents, did you hear a lot from people?
Not as much as on other issues that were confronting the legislature. Surprisingly, people get into the gun issues, for example, were huge. We got so many emails on those, and the budget and sales tax issues. I got a lot of emails on that. The medical marijuana was not so much.
Mm-hmm.
And I think because we have a very conservative district here.
Yeah, we do. Well, we have to take a quick break before we continue our conversation with Senator Kathleen Pasadena. Now is a great time to send in your questions for the senator. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. You can also give us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. We're taking a break because WGCU is in the midst of its 3-day June radio pledge drive. It's called Nourish Your Mind, Nourish Your Body. It's a way for you to support WGCU and for that support to go a little bit further thanks to Naples Restaurant Week. There's still time to make a donation to support WGCU and the local programming you enjoy, like Gulf Coast Live, and here's how. I'm Julie Glenn. This is Gulf Coast Live. Thanks for staying with us. We are talking with Senator Kathleen Pasadena from Florida's District 28, which is Southern Lee County, Collier County, and Hendry County. Call in with your questions about what was accomplished this past year in the legislative session and what to expect as lawmakers head back to Tallahassee for a special session beginning on Wednesday. Call in with your questions at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we are at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Senator Pasadena, you've represented Southwest Florida in the State House for 6 years before making the jump to the Senate this year. Is there a big difference between the two?
It's a huge difference. Well, first of all, there's 120 House members and only 40 senators. And so one senator can make a big difference. One senator can change legislation. One senator can be much more effective. House members, because you're only one of 120, it's hard to really get anything done unless you get a whole group of people involved.
Yeah, so you have to have more than one person signing on to things. And, well, another thing, as a freshman senator, you introduced about 36 bills, and you were able to get 13 of them passed this legislative session. And that's a lot more than people that have been there for a long time are able to get past. How did you do that?
I'm like a dog with a bone. I was so aggressive. I'm not sure I'll do that again because it nearly killed me. It is really hard because, you know, not just filing the bills, but every bill gets referred to three or sometimes four committees. And so the Senate president this year required everybody to present their own bill. So every one of those bills, I had to present three and four times. And I like to joke that I ran up and down the stairs between the committee rooms at the Capitol. I should have lost a lot of weight from running up and down the stairs, particularly in high heels.
The legislative stairmaster.
Yeah. It was pretty wild.
So, I mean, what if you got something scheduled, the committee in the same day, same time?
That is the hardest part. And so what you have to do is you have to work with the committee chairs to fit you in depending on the time because the committees do meet at the same time. That's why you're running up and down the stairs. So I could be presenting three bills in one committee, run out, run up the stairs to the committee that's meeting at the same time and get it done there. And half the times I have all my books with me. They're flying everywhere. It's pretty fun. But, you know, and you had to be calm and answer questions and not get flustered.
And you have to be prepared.
Yes.
And be able to switch gears from one bill to another. Are there any that really stand out to you that are memorable that you're super proud of?
Well, this year, one bill that I really liked, it was a bill about electronic wells. And I really liked it. It did it had a lot of opposition, believe it or not, from some estate planners, I think, because there was, I believe, a fear of maybe losing a little ground there. But the reason I liked it was, you know, there's so many people, particularly young people, who don't have the time, the money, or the initiative to actually do a will. And it's really important to have an estate plan, particularly if you have kids. And so this allows you to create a will and sign it and file it and store it online. And
is that through a state program?
It would have to be a qualified organization would have to do this. So they'd have to be licensed by the state to hold these wills. But it's all done by video camera and everything. So I kind of like the modernization of it, moving us into the modern world. So I like that.
So I'm kind of thinking like TurboTax to help you do your taxes. Is it kind of similar to that?
Yeah, but because it's a will, which is totally different, and you're disposing of property after your death, you have to document it properly. And
okay.
So having a videotape of you signing your will, it's pretty cool.
Oh, wow.
Another bill that I loved that was such a simple thing was a bill that was brought to me by some high school students from Hillsborough County that have a program in their classroom. They do it every year called There Ought to Be a Law. And it was some young ladies, the girls in the class came up with this idea. And they wanted to have an exemption on the sales tax on feminine products. Believe it or not, there is a sales tax on a necessity like feminine products. There is no sales tax on hair restoration products like Rogaine, but we're paying sales tax on feminine products. So they came up with this idea. I filed the bill, and it was a lot of fun to work with these students to sponsor the bill, and it got into our big tax package that the governor signed. I got a lot of positive feedback. The other thing I found out is, and I'd like to work on this in the future, is we also have a sales tax on diapers. Yeah. You know, the young families who can least afford to pay, especially how expensive they are, paying sales tax on something that is a necessity. And in Florida, we do not tax necessities. So it was fun to work on that. It was also important, and you know, and it's a savings to people who can least afford it. So.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people even noticed that or knew that.
Right.
About that, I didn't know Florida had a "we don't tax necessities" thing.
It's if you want to have a laugh someday, go to the Department of Revenue's website and see what products are exempted from sales tax. It's all over the place. It's crazy things because originally the sales tax came into being in the 1940s when we were looking for additional revenue and everything was taxed. Well, over the years since the 1940s, when some legislator would get an idea, there would be a specific bill to exempt a certain product. Now, obviously, medicine and things like that are not taxed, but in general, necessities are not taxed. Food is not taxed. Band-Aids aren't taxed. I was laughing. Every time I presented the feminine hygiene bill, I said, well, corn pads aren't taxed, so why can't we?
Corn pads? Yeah. Oh, for your corns on your feet.
Yeah, I know. So why can't we repeal the sales tax on the other kind of pads? So those kind of things.
I'm sitting here trying to visualize an ear of corn. I'm like, what? Yeah, okay, I got you.
Stuff like that. That's why I love doing what I do, because things like that are just, you know, they make my day.
I bet you look back in some state laws and you can find some throwback odd things that are still kind of lingering around in there.
Sure.
Addressing Florida's dangerous roads and the unique dangers that they pose for cyclists. That's been a big goal of yours for a lot of years.
And it will be.
Why is that? Is there a personal experience that relates to that?
Absolutely. My law partner was riding with his Velo group a couple of years ago, traveling lawfully, and were making a lawful turn. They had the hand signals out. They're doing the whole thing. And a pickup truck went speeding by and obviously didn't see him and hit him, knocked him 60 feet in the air, and he landed on his head. And he was in the hospital for a while, broke half the bones of his body. And he went from being a young, vibrant young man to like an old man. And it really it bothered me, because the man who hit him only got like a $200 ticket. And, you know, we have – so here's the problem. Whenever I give a talk about vulnerable road users, as we call it, I will – in a room of 200 people, I'll say, how many people in this room ride bicycles? Half the people raise their hand. Then my other question is, how many people in this room hate cyclists? And the other half raise their hand. It is a huge problem, because sharing the road has got so much misinformation. So many people don't obey the law, whether it's motor vehicle or bicycles or pedestrians. And we have to do something on a statewide level, because we want people to come here. We want tourists to come here. They love to ride bicycles. We want the blue zone thing. We want healthy people. We encourage people to walk, run, cycle. And yet our roads are not made for that kind of travel. To share. And so I've made that one of my missions, to do something. And I've filed a bill every year. Every year it gets knocked down, but I'm going to keep doing it till something happens.
So what does that bill say? What do you want it to do? Fix the roads to make them have more room for bikes?
No, you know, that's going to be hard. How do you do that?
You can't retro. I mean, I guess going forward, new roads, yeah.
Exactly. And that's what we are doing. But it's certain things like tweaking the law in some respect, like the 3-foot rule or the right turns, who has the right of way, requirement of stopping. For example, right now, everyone has to stop at a stop sign. So technically, if you're on a bicycle in a group of 10 people, every one of you has to stop at the stop sign. So you'd have bicycle stop, car stop, bicycle car, bicycle car. That drives everybody crazy. So nobody follows the law, and then there are issues. So we need to kind of look, what is our modern day life like, and how do we create laws that reflect that keep people safe?
And then also education to get people to know what the laws actually are.
Well, absolutely. You know, until recently, the driver's test and the driver's manual did not even have information on cycling and what the relationship is and who has what, when, and where, what motor vehicles do versus bicycles.
So another thing that we were talking about a little bit during the break is the workers' compensation insurance, and other issue that has stoked a lot of tensions in Tallahassee. Last year we saw a big increase in what businesses pay towards workers' comp, and lawmakers didn't pass anything on that issue this year. Can you explain to our listeners why workers' comp payments are an issue, and what's the best way to move forward, do you think?
Yeah, that was one of the biggest disappointments I had. I felt we had this session. What happened was, last year the Supreme Court held that our workers' comp statute was unconstitutional with regard to an injured worker's ability to get an attorney to represent them. And it's a long, convoluted story of how we got there. But the bottom line is, they determined that it would be difficult for someone with a small dollar claim to get access to courts, so which is a constitutionally guaranteed right. So with that holding our statute unconstitutional. The rates are just going through the roof. We tried to do a fix this session. The House and the Senate couldn't agree, and it all related to attorney's fees. You know, and that's really tragic. And I'm an attorney. It really bothers me that what we're doing is fighting over attorney's fees in something that is going to cost the citizens of our state a lot of money.
And another thing costing money, property insurance rate hikes are another issue. They're going to hit a lot of people down here in Southwest Florida, right in the bottom line. The Fort Myers News Press reports that insurers say they're experiencing an increase in fraud going back to 2012, often linked to a practice known as assignment of benefits. So I understand you've been working with fellow Senator Dorothy Huckel to address this in the future. What is the problem and how are you going to try to fix that?
It's a real scam, actually, what's happening. Very simply, I'll give an example. You wake up in the middle of the night. It's 3 o'clock in the morning and your, you know, washing machine hose broken. There's water everywhere. And, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, that's when it always happens. So what do? Yeah. You call a water remediation specialist. First of all, I'll say that most of them locally are great. They do a great job. They'll come out. They clean it up. They dry it up. And we're fine. What's going on? Some of these unscrupulous company, they come out, they hand you a piece of paper, they sign this, and it's basically assigning your rights to insurance proceeds away. And so basically they take you out of the equation. They deal with your insurance company. And the problem is they start doing work that the insurance company doesn't authorize. They try to milk the whole thing. Then they get a lawyer and then we're off to the races. And you, the homeowner, are completely out of the process. You may not have wanted to do that kind of work. You may not have wanted to sue the insurance company. So now they're all suing each other. And the bottom line is if the insurance company doesn't pay because it's not covered, the water remediation company hires a contractor to do the work. And then they can't work it out. There's a lawsuit. And who gets sued? The homeowner. So there's a lot. It's a real problem, particularly Miami-Dade and Broward counties. And
is this so? The legislation that you want to put forward, would it maybe address these contractors and that type of signing away of your rights?
Absolutely. It gives the homeowner more protection, more rights. Once they wake up and after they've seen this whole thing and they look at it, they can terminate and the contract. I mean, pay for the work that's been done. And I mean, it's kind of complicated, but suffice it to say that we need to make sure that the consumers are not being harmed by this practice, and they are.
Well, and then the insurance companies are raising the rates on everybody.
Oh, absolutely.
As a result of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask, we've seen the Second Amendment bills coming up in both the House and the Senate. And this year, no more than 17 gun-related bills were proposed, ranging from bans on certain types of rifles by lawmakers from Orlando and Fort Lauderdale, scenes of recent gun violence, including the Pulse nightclub shooting a year ago this month. Some of those gun bills also seek to expand the rights to carry firearms in certain places, including concealed carry on college campuses. What is your stance on some of these laws, and where do you think the balance should lie between individuals' Second Amendment rights and public policy?
Well, first of all, in terms of all the bills that were filed, only one passed this year in both chambers, and that was updating the Stand Your Ground law to change the burden of proof from the defendant to the prosecutor. And we all voted for that, of course, on party lines. With regard to all the other bills, I am definitely and will always be a proponent of everyone's Second Amendment rights. And the thing about it is we're focusing, I think, on the wrong issue. Really, what we need to do is, you see what happened like with the Pulse and everything else. These kind of horrific acts that the gun control people want to stop are done by people who have huge problems. These are not law-abiding citizens.
So you're looking into like more of a mental health angle.
I have been saying all along, I want to put more dollars into mental health as much as we possibly can. And we're not doing it. We're at the bottom of the barrel of the states insofar as funding for mental health. These these people that do these horrific acts, they weren't born that way. Something happened to them when they were children, more than likely, that took them off that just made them unbalanced. And if we don't do something about it, gun control isn't going to do anything, because all it's going to do is just take guns. Law-abiding people are going to obey the law. So if you have control, people will who obey the law will, you know, put their guns away or do whatever. But the people with problems and the criminals, they don't care what the law is. So
how do you see the state legislature being able to address mental health issues? I mean, putting money towards it, I mean, you still have a person that has to elect to go and get help.
Well, I think we have to start first with the kids. You know, I have a lot of friends who are teachers, and without exception, they know who are the kids that have problems, that are going to be problems, because they deal with them every day. And they see issues at home, and they see issues with bullying and all kinds of things. And so we've got to put the money, I think, right away to identify kids that have issues and get them help. And
can there be are you talking about maybe putting some kind of mental health help within schools, so that when teachers find someone, they can refer to that within the school?
I would love to do that. I'd love to have – we do have counseling. But most of the school's counselors are doing other things like scheduling and testing. And you have to have counselors to help them, the students that want to go to college, to work on their
It ends up being career counseling.
Career
and guidance,
counseling.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so many other issues. It would be huge dollars. But I think if we can intervene early in the lives of these kids that have issues, won't it pay off in the end?
I think that would be such a challenge, though, figuring out what part of the budget to take from to put there, because it's very hard to quantify the results in a lot of these cases.
Well, that's the devil is in the details, particularly on the budget. You know, when you talk about the budget, that's our number one job. And so when we meet with people in Tallahassee, 9 out of 10 times it's about budget items, and every single person, every single agency, every single nonprofit, every single entity that is looking for state funding will come to your office and sit down in front of you and look you in the eye and say, this is the most important project in the state. And if you fund this project, you will save millions at the back end. And you know what? They really believe that. But you can't fund every single project. So you have to kind of go through it. And that's why we have these issues every year with the House and the Senate and on budgets, because everybody has a different take on what's important.
So now that leads me to the question, what made you want to get into this line of work? I mean, it's hard. It's challenging. So what made you want to get involved in politics?
Well, I've been in Naples for, I'll be 38 years. And when I first moved to Naples, there were so few first of all, I was like the third woman attorney. One of the things you did for business development was get involved in business and professional and charitable organizations. And so I did. And over the years, I was involved in so many of them. But it always ended up with, oh, we want to do this, we want to do that, or how can we do this? And there was always that, well, the legislature, you have to get approval. And so I've always had in the back of my mind I wanted to run for office, but I honestly couldn't do it till I have three children, and my youngest daughter, when she graduated from high school, I said, okay, now's the time. So I ran and got elected, and here I am.
Has it been what you thought it would be like?
No. It's not at all. I really didn't have a good idea. I mean, I've been watching too many episodes of The West Wing or Veep or whatever. It's a lot of you know, daily work. It's a lot of mind work, you know, reading, writing. It kind of goes with my practice of law. I mean, that's what you do all day.
It's a lot of research, yeah. And familiarizing yourself.
Exactly. But you know what? When you get something done, whether it's one little thing, one little bill that you've worked really hard on that's important to somebody in your district.
I just saw you light up over the electronic wills and testaments. I mean, so yeah, you can see the feeling of accomplishment.
Well, and a lot of what I've done too has been because we have mostly older residents in Southwest Florida. Every year I make sure I do a bill dealing with our vulnerable adults, our older population, and you know I try to focus a lot of energies there because we do a lot of things for kids, which is great. We do a lot of things for businesses, but you know our forgotten forgotten group are older citizens. And so to me, if I can get a bill passed that or get some dollars for our older citizen, I really feel like I've done something great.
And with Harry Chapin, you got
that. Was so cool. That was so cool. Yeah.
So are you going to be running for re-election, do you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we're term limited in the Florida legislature. So I had a 2-year term because of redistricting. So I can run. I'm running in 2018 for a 4-year term. And then we'll see after that.
Any thoughts about Washington?
No.
No?
No.
Are you going to keep it local?
Yeah, I'm too old to go. I'm going to do as much as I can on a statewide level and then go off into the sunset.
And you mentioned earlier that you feel like that's really where you need to be, where you need to, where things can get done.
Yeah. I mean, and you think of one of 40, you know, there's a lot we can get done. When I look at the list of projects that we got funded in Southwest Florida, we have a great delegation. Senator Beniquisto in Fort Myers and myself, we worked like a team, did a lot along with our House members. We worked so collaboratively and collegially. We all agreed on, okay, what projects are we going to support? How are we going to get it done? And I think we accomplished a great deal. That is not the case in other areas in the state.
Yeah, making it a regional thing too.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank our guest, Senator Kathleen Pasadomo. Good luck with the special session starting on Wednesday. I'll let you take off and go pack. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith with help from John Davis. Our director is Richard Chinqui, and our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.